People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. When a new deadly virus broke out in Toronto in 2003, it fell to Bob Maunder and John Hunter to help people in the SARS ward cope. The pair are psychiatrists who these days work in Sinai Health in Toronto, and both are also professors at the University of Toronto. Ever since SARS, a lot of their work has been focused on coping, how people respond and manage in the face of stressful circumstances. They've put together a compendium of coping strategies supported by evidence in a new book called Coping: Fix Problems, Find Meaning, and Feel Better. It spells out a three-step approach for anyone facing a difficult problem. Fix it if you can, feel better about the things you can't fix, and find ways to create purpose and meaning, even if you're still suffering. I spoke with Dr. Bob Maunder and Dr. John Hunter about coping.
Yeah, I'm a psychiatrist. I've been working at Sinai Health for over 30 years, and I'm also a professor at the University of Toronto.
I'm almost exactly the same guy. My name is John Hunter. I'm a psychiatrist at Mount Sinai for over 30 years. Bob and I tend to see folks with serious medical illness within the realm of people that could be seen by psychiatry. That's kind of where we focus.
Both of you have been working to help people cope with things since the SARS outbreak in Toronto circa more than 20 years ago. What do you think people have to gain from maybe thinking more intentionally about coping?
Well, I think thinking intentionally about coping is like part of the key to coping effectively, because like we're all under stress of one kind or another every day, sometimes kind of the usual hassles and sometimes more severe. And most of us don't even think about coping until a situation is kind of severe enough that we're not sure whether we have the capacity to respond to it effectively or not. And those are the times where it's helpful to start to intentionally think, you know, is this a problem that I can deal with? Do I have the resources? Is this worth paying attention to, you know, in a series of questions that are thoughtful?
Well, to that end, how do you know when it's time to cope? Like, I imagine there are some situations where it's obvious, the death of a loved one, the end of a relationship, but I imagine there are a ton of other circumstances where maybe it's sort of less clear, but you still are coping with something.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know that there's like a red line that you cross where you know now is the time to cope. Most people are pretty good problem solvers, and so we face most troubles that come up in a problem-solving frame. And it's usually when that's not working very well that people start to think, well, what else can I do? Like, is there some better way to solve this problem, or do I need to move on to a different kind of tactic?
I would maybe identify two potential flags. One is when you start to feel bad, when you're sad enough, anxious enough, sleepless enough. And linked with that would be the second flag, which is when your functioning drops off. You're not able to concentrate as well. You're maybe not doing as well at work, that kind of thing. So tough emotions and lower function might be times to clue you into when you need to formally address coping a bit more.
And the two of you have suggested this, well, to really simplify it, this three-step method of: number one, identify what you're dealing with. If it's a problem you can solve, then solve it and you're done. If it's not a problem that's really easy to solve, then do something to feel better about it. And, you know, if the problem persists, then you just got to find some way to find meaning in your life despite it. What kind of context do you think it's important people know about maybe that algorithm for coping?
Well, a couple of things. One is we didn't invent those three steps, or we didn't make them up. They come from evidence. So that Those three different ways of approaching coping come from a synthesis of evidence of how people with really serious disease, the original evidence came from people who were coping with HIV or with cancer back in the 90s. That there's a logical sequence, but there's also kind of an effective sequence of how people deal with things like that. And we've simplified that for the sake of having something that's easy to remember and easy to teach into just three steps, right? Exactly as you said, try to pro solve the problem if it's worth solving and you think you can. If that doesn't work, you move on to the next step, which is doing a whole variety of things to feel better with problems that you haven't fixed, which is really the kind of range of things that most people think of as coping per se. And when suffering persists even beyond that, to focus on meaning, which is maybe the deepest, most important, but kind of way of coping, but it's also like the big gun that we reserve for the biggest problems.
And there's also the idea of is very context dependent, but maybe good coping versus bad coping, or coping that, might lead you to have other problems as a result of the coping. What do you think it's important people know about the idea of maybe good versus bad coping?
Yeah, that's a great question. The book, within the book, there are a number of interviews with people that have had to deal with one issue or another. And there's several times in those interviews where people told us that they coped with difficulty in their life by using substances, for instance. And we'd be hard pressed to say that using substances is something we'd like to recommend to people. On the other hand, it's clear that for those individuals at that point in time, it was what they had available and what they could use to manage. They have each subsequently gone on to say, and then I gave it up because it had too much cost for me. So it's easy to condemn that at the moment as saying, well, you shouldn't use drugs to cope. But on the other hand, they didn't have another strategy for coping. They were in extremis, they were in tough circumstances, and it got them through something that was unmanageable otherwise. So again, it's not that we're recommending that, but you can imagine in a less dramatic circumstance where, to use one of the things Bob says in the book, this is not the time to adhere to your kale salad for your meal. This is a time where you indulge a little bit and have a hamburger or a piece of cake or something, because that'll make you feel better. That's not bad coping. That's just recognizing that there are moments where you got to look after yourself in a certain kind of way without being rigid.
Yeah, I would add to that another example where the stakes are maybe not as high as with substance use, where John's exactly right. Like each of our interview subjects who had gone through a period of life where they were using substances to cope, there was not a single one of them who, in retrospect, called that bad coping or disapproved of themselves for having done that. And each one of them had found a way to move on to some kind of healthier, more effective way of coping over time. A kind of lower stakes version of the same kind of trade-off is distraction. Like most people think that distracting yourself from a problem is ineffective, useless, problematic coping. And yet it is one of the most commonly used forms of coping. And when balanced with other things that are kind of more directly facing a problem, distraction is actually not a pretty good thing to have in your tool belt as one of the various ways that you cope, as opposed to denial, like not even acknowledging that you have a problem, which is like almost never helpful.
Or ruminating, just focusing on it and not getting anywhere with it. You better distract yourself.
You've also suggested that when you're faced with a really serious problem, the kind that is going to require you to cope in a big way, that it's not going to be a time where you're going to be maybe in the right frame of mind to step back and say, well, what is the best, most scientifically effective way to cope with this problem? So what do you think it's important for people to know about that idea that, like, when you're already really stressed, it's going to be hard to learn to cope better? How do you learn to cope better when you're not really stressed, so that you have the tools when it's time?
Yeah, so that's John likes to say it's always two things, right? So, like, the two things in this case are learning new ways to cope, expanding your repertoire of skills on the one hand, and returning to the things you're most comfortable with and doing the stuff that you don't have to do, where you don't have to learn anything on the other hand. And we recommend both of those, but it's a matter of kind of timing, which is most useful. And I think you said it, in the middle of a situation that feels kind of very stressful and overwhelming is no time to try and learn anything, right? So it's not a great idea in the midst of overwhelming stress to think, okay, I need to now try and employ some coping strategy that I've never done before and I don't know how to do. It's not a time to learn. That's a time to return to the most effective things that you've managed and the most comfortable ways of coping that you've had over the years. And during the times when life is a little gentler than that, it's very helpful to expand the range of things that you can do, particularly in that kind of second step of coping, the dealing with feeling better in spite of problems you can't fix. There's lots of coping tactics in there that are skills based, right? And learning new skills at a time when you're not feeling so stressed, things like whether that's meditation or yoga or building up some new pattern of exercising and living in a healthy way or whatever it is, those are good things to kind of focus on as projects during the times when you're not so stressed so that you can use them when you need them.
Let me add to that by exploiting the question, Joe. The premise of the question is that the person's operating by themselves. And of course, most of us in the world, if we're lucky anyway, are in relationship with other people. So I might reframe the question to say, how can you help out a friend or a loved one when you see them doing the same old thing and not getting any further with it? You know, if they're coping in a way that is familiar to you and you know that it's going to end up with them feeling frustrated or something else, think of how you might be able to help that person see that there's a different pathway they could follow. And the kind of meta message I'm trying to deliver by saying that is, let's use relationship. Let's work as pairs or as families where we can to try to support one another.
Well, you have suggested in the book that a lot of our stress comes from our relationships with other people and managing those relationships. And likewise, a lot of our comfort comes from our relationships with other people. You spend a lot of time in the book talking about attachment theory. And I'm wondering if you could explain why that framework is something that is useful to understand when it comes to coping.
Exactly as you say, both stress and coping are deeply related to relationships. So most of the stresses that we experience in life have been caused by somebody. And our most effective ways of coping are actually in relationship with others, right? So that the way that we relate to the people that matter in our lives is really crucial to experiencing stress and to coping. Attachment theory is a way to understand how we have different preferences in terms of the kinds of ways of relating that make us feel most comfortable. The premise is that everybody wants to feel secure. Everybody wants to feel comfort with others. And for some people, the way that they're most comfortable with others is to keep them at a bit of a distance to maintain their kind of their self-reliance and autonomy. For other people, they feel most comfortable if others are close and they can count on them and they sort of depend on others. And a third group would be kind of flexibly able to use both of those strategies. That third group is usually the most comfortable. That's the most flexible way to be. That's called secure. And that's a well-supported psychological theory. It's a solid basis for understanding how relationships work. And we use that because that helps us to understand kind of which relationship strategies are going to be most effective for which people. So we were talking about when to try new things, try new tactics, develop your skills, and when to return to comfortable things. Attachment theory helps us understand relationally which strategies are going to be most comfortable and which are going to be kind of new and need to be learned for somebody. So if your preference is to keep people at a distance in the middle of stress, it is no time to try and learn how to be closer to people and kind of tolerate intimacy and use relationships, and vice versa for the other relationships. So we spend a little bit of time teaching people about attachment so they'll understand their own style and how that relates to which relationship strategies might be most comfortable and which other ones they might want to think about spending some time developing skills in.
Now, when it comes to attachment theory, it categorizes people into different attachment styles. There are these two axes. There's one for avoidance, there's one for anxiety. And there's this idea that most people are going to fall into one of these categories, and that it's possible to maybe shift your attachment style to the ideal one, secure, but it's going to be very difficult. So, what would you say to someone who maybe identifies with one of the attachment styles that maybe is associated with having more difficulty than the others?
Yeah, I would reframe it a little bit there, Joe. I don't think the recommendation or the expectation is that people can shift their attachment style to the preferable one. That's something somebody might want to do and might work at doing and might engage, for instance, in a psychotherapy to help them along with it. But in the midst of crisis, as Bob said a couple times now, it's not a time to look to make kind of fundamental changes to your operating system, if you will. I think the recommendation in the book has more to do with know thyself. Look at it, get a sense of who you are and how you operate. And then with that knowledge, do the things that fit with your competencies. Because even though there's this kind of inference that secure is the best, and the insecure ones are, as implied by a term like insecure, not as good. They're each formed in the life of an individual to be the best strategy for that person's developmental origins. So you're lucky if you grow up and you get to be secure. That implies you had a good socioeconomic resource, secure parenting, consistency in childhood, that sort of thing. But if in fact your life was a little tougher in some ways, one of these other attachment styles was likely to have evolved because it was just a better way of managing the situation in which you were brought up. And it may continue to have its advantages in coping with some tough circumstances in life as well.
This is People First Radio. My guests are Bob Maunder and John Hunter. The pair are psychiatrists and professors at the University of Toronto. They're also the authors of Coping, Fix Problems, Find Meaning, and Live Better. It provides an evidence-based roadmap for dealing with stress. As we'll hear more about later on, it also shares stories of people's real-world experiences coping in the face of trauma.
I might say something in addition, Joe, that's a kind of an overarching idea that I think this conversation has bounced off of a couple of times. There's a myriad of stressors in the world. There's a thousand things that people are going to be stressed by. There's a thousand ways of coping. And we can call that stressor a good stressor or a bad stressor. We can call that coping a good coping or a bad coping. They get mixed up together. And what we're speaking about or hoping people will take away from this book is you've got strengths, you've got capacities, you've got abilities. You can do certain things in certain ways. Know yourself. Figure out what suits your circumstances. If you can solve the problem, why not just solve the problem? That's simple and straightforward. But if you're stuck at that level, then bump up the ladder to step two or step three. And don't spend a lot of time agonizing over whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But recognize that you're doing your best to cope and adapt and manage in a difficult circumstance.
So in a way, it's really like I'm thinking even the parts of the algorithm that aren't solve the problem that's stressing you out are in a way sort of solve the problem of feeling discombobulated by finding, well, understanding it as best you can and then finding some kind of way to deal with it that helps with the consequence of feeling really discombobulated.
Yeah, and I think you remind me there, and so I'll add that the idea of three steps and move from step one to step two to step three is really helpful because it's so simple, right? And it's helpful to kind of orient yourself when you're feeling overwhelmed to a kind of simple approach to what might I do next. But one of the reasons why interviews that John did with a dozen or so people in the book are so helpful, I think, is that there is not a single person that he interviewed that went from step one to step two to step three and they're coping with some pretty trying life circumstances. People do what they have to do. And in the real world, some people start at finding purpose and meaning in their life, and that helps them work backwards to doing things that allow them to feel better or to problem solve. And so the sequence is kind of a sequence for teaching and a sequence for remembering. It's a way to organize your thoughts, as a way to think of what to do next. In real life, as John says, there are a myriad of ways of coping. And one of the kind of underlying messages of the book is to be gentle with yourself, work on your strengths, and allow yourself the full range of things that you have found helpful, regardless of whether other people think they're good or bad.
One thing I found really interesting in the book was you've suggested that venting too much can actually be a particularly bad thing. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that idea.
It's pretty common to, I mean, venting, I think it's pretty clear what that is, but for anybody for whom that feels like jargon, venting is just like expressing your negative feelings directly and, you know, talking about whatever you're angry about typically, or whatever you're having other negative feelings about. Everybody does that from time to time. And the idea that too much of that is not great strategy really comes from evidence, right? So we've measured coping strategies and people experiencing several different kinds of stress over the years. And the people who endorse venting as one of the more prominent ways in which they're coping are very consistently the people who are actually coping less effectively and struggling more with the consequences of their coping. So it just kind of comes from experience and evidence that it turns out that that's not very helpful. It's inevitable that it will be part of somebody's coping strategy. And so our thoughtful caution about that is don't lean on it too heavily.
I'll invoke the relationship paradigm again. It's implied in what Bob is saying there is it's okay to vent every now and then, right? Like everybody's got moments where they want to vent. If you rely on it too heavily, then there's probably somebody standing in front of you at the other end of the phone call who's heard you vent a whole bunch of times, and here you are venting yet again. And imagine that person's experience, right? They're just hearing about more stuff that is problematic, that keeps recurring, that doesn't get dealt with, and there doesn't seem anything they can do about it. Right. So in fact, it ends up being kind of isolating. It's likely that the person I enter the phone call is going to move away. This is not as evidence-based as what Bob was saying. This is my conjecture. But I can imagine that that's part of the reason why it doesn't pay off as a coping strategy, is because it ends up not either dealing with the problem in some kind of constructive way or recruiting support.
Yeah, I embroider on that a little bit, you know, that it, because that helps to explain why a little bit's okay and a lot is probably too much. Because if you imagine like a single person hearing your venting, when they're hearing it for the first time and they're hearing it a bit, it's pretty easy to respond to that empathically. That's most people's instinct, is to say, oh, that's too bad. And I can imagine that really difficult situation you were in, and I understand why you're feeling so angry. 10 minutes later, it gets less and less easy to empathize, right? And so there's a limit to how much venting works kind of interpersonally, relationally.
So do you think it's fair to say that maybe the line between confiding a challenge in someone else that you trust and venting has to do with doing it a lot or doing it for a long time or doing it over and over and over again about sort of the same thing?
Yeah, I think somewhere in that list, right? And I think the repetitiveness is definitely a factor, and the kind of one tone emotional expression of it is also a factor for how that works relationally. Confiding in somebody is typically a little bit more nuanced than just ranting about how bad you feel.
Now, you shared in the book that your journey working with people around coping really got started during SARS just over 20 years ago in Toronto, which was a really scary time by all accounts. I'm wondering if you could tell me, both of you really, about what you retained from that experience or how you went about trying to help people 20 years ago when they had severe acute respiratory syndrome, and it was this new thing, it was this scary thing, it was this oftentimes fatal thing. How did you approach helping people cope in that circumstance?
There's about, I'll take a stab at this first. There's about three levels that I can think of responding to that, Joe. One is pragmatically what we did in the hospital. And Bob and I were the guys who went up to the, quote, SARS unit, which was specified sort of walled off area of the hospital where people with known SARS infections were hospitalized and looked after. And we gowned up and we put on one mask, two masks, a face mask, you know, double gloves, and went and spoke to people every day to see if we could support them and give them a chance to vent and otherwise be useful. We did that day in and day out for a number of weeks or months. So that was trying to help the SARS patients themselves. Then there was a response at the level of the hospital staff. It was incredibly difficult to be hospital staff during this time. People were dealing with the fears of being infected. They were dealing with the fears of taking infection home. There's some really awful cases of people being sort of ostracized because they worked at the hospital. And the Department of Psychiatry here at Mount Sinai was at the forefront of leading a kind of hospital support strategy, which had many different components to it. And then the third thing I would add, which we didn't really talk about much in the book when we were introducing this, is that, you know, we had families at home too, right? We had wives and little kids, and they were worried and scared, maybe not so little kids, but young adults. And we had a role to play in supporting them and keeping them safe and keeping them okay. So we did a lot, and as I think is implied by the book, we, in the same way that we supported other staff, we supported each other, and other staff supported us, and our families supported us to help us get through it.
Yeah, I would just add a bit of the subsequent history to that, right? Because before Before SARS, John and I were doing the kind of psychiatry that he described before. We were providing psychiatric care for people who have like serious physical illness. That's our kind of psychiatry. And we were studying attachment theory and so how a relationship could help with disease. We had our scholarly work and our clinical work, but we never thought of ourselves as teaching about coping or helping colleagues with resilience. That wasn't like part of our gig. And then SARS happened, and SARS was, it seems so small in retrospect now that we've been through the COVID pandemic, but at the time it was a very terrifying, memorable experience, and it was widely understood to have been much worse than it had to be because we were so unprepared for it. And so everybody started preparing for the next event, which was then thought likely to be a flu epidemic about a decade after SARS. And so in those years, we intentionally developed a way of thinking about coping and helping colleagues with stress and teaching about coping, which is the beginnings of the kind of teaching that we do in this book. And that all derived directly from SARS, because it wasn't our plan to do that. That was a change in plan that occurred because of the SARS experience.
And you've both been focusing on coping for decades now. And in the course of writing this book, John, you did a number of interviews with people who were sharing some of the ways that they coped with a number of diverse life experiences, things like finding out you have imminently terminal cancer at a very young age, things like the death of all your immediate family members in a very short time span, things like sort of getting yourself into a marriage that you're not loving and then having a child who has some difficulties. What did you learn, John, maybe doing these interviews decades into the field of coping? Like, what did they teach you about this thing that you had been studying for so long?
I think the revelation for me, Joe, was that being a clinician, psychiatrist in a hospital, we are seeing people with, if I could put it this way, who qualify as patients. That's why they're in the hospital. You know, they're getting treated. And so another doctor is saying they need to be treated by psychiatry too. So there's a kind of a selection for people that have clearly identifiable stressors and difficulties. The interviews were not of patients. The interviews were of people. We sort of put out a call to colleagues and said, you know, we're interested in hearing how people cope. Let us know if you know somebody who might be willing to participate. And that's why there's this incredibly broad range of things that people spoke about dealing with. And we don't see those folks unless they cross some sort of clinical threshold. And it was remarkable to me that so many folks were dealing with really substantial stressors and really managing them well without crossing a clinical threshold. So it actually makes you wonder, not to divert us, but what qualifies for somebody to cross a clinical threshold, right? It's not how tough their life is. It's not how much struggle they've had. It's not how difficult things have been, because there's lots of folks, as shown by the interviews out there, dealing with quite profound difficulty and dealing with it admirably.
Yeah, the thing I would add to that is, I mean, we did, just as John said, just kind of sent out flyers, sent out word to colleagues to say, we'd like to talk to some people about coping. Let us know if there's somebody who would talk to us about that. And we thought going into that then we would pick and choose the kind of good teaching examples, you know, to include in the book as illustrations. And in the end, we used every single interview because everybody had something to say about their very stressful lives and how they cope with that. And we had no reason to select some out than others. It just seems to be the norm that people deal with a lot and that they have developed their own way of dealing with it.
you've shared the idea that like everyone is coping with something, and your interviews kind of demonstrated that. You were thinking, hey, maybe we'll get a couple of really interesting ones that we'll single out and highlight. And then everyone you talked to had a story that was really interesting and that was worth sharing. So you do that. And then you also have this expertise from a few decades of studying. This is what the evidence says about coping. This is what the evidence says is maybe like more likely to be effective. Where do those two things meet? Where do the experiences that you hear from people when you see that everyone is dealing with something, they're dealing with things in different ways, where does that rubber meet with the road of here's what the evidence says? Like, what do you think people can take away from the evidence if, or on top of the fact that you've talked to all of these people and they're coping in their own unique way?
Yeah, so I'll take a stab at that. I suspect we'll have different answers to that. I think that's a great question, because it gets at the two ways that we kind of assemble advice, if you will, about coping, right? And one is just what emerges from the data, and we try to be really evidence-based. And the other is, how does that pass through the filter of our experience of how people actually cope in the world and what they choose to do? And so there's a hope is that there's some kind of meeting of the evidence and wisdom in that approach. What the evidence is really helpful as a kind of commentary on what people report anecdotally, because some of the things that people swear by actually have like fairly weak evidence for their effectiveness in coping. And so that's useful to know. And the one that was striking that's coming to mind right now is when you're looking at kind of skills-based ways of dealing with stress, a lot of people we know absolutely swear by exercise as the singular thing that is most effective for them to help with coping. And so it was a little bit surprising to see that the evidence base for the effectiveness of exercise, specifically for stress and coping, not for its all the great things that it does for health in general, but it's the evidence that it is helpful as a coping strategy is okay, but it's kind of weak. It's nothing like the evidence that a yoga practice or a mindfulness practice is effective for coping, which is really robust, strong evidence. And I would have guessed that those are kind of equal contenders before reviewing the evidence specifically for that part of the book. So it's helpful to draw both from people's experience and from what the science shows.
I would just almost refine what I said before. People out there are coping, and they're getting by, and they're managing things. And part of my reaction was, this is admirable, right? What people manage on their own, I'm astonished at it. I would also add, though, that it wasn't without distress. A lot of people out there, although they were coping, although they were getting through the day and stuff, it was hard on them and it was difficult. And I'd hold out a hope that if people knew more of this kind of strategy, or thought of themselves as having some choices about how they move through these problems, that they might be able to do it with less angst or less despair.
Bob, John, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on this.
Thanks for inviting us. We're thrilled to be interested.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's great to be able to talk.
Bob Maunder and John Hunter are professors at the University of Toronto and psychiatrists working at Sinai Health, also in Toronto. The pair are authors of Coping, Fix Problems, Find Meaning, and Live Better.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY in Nanaimo, on CFMH in St. John, on CFUV in Victoria, on Dig FM in the Comox Valley, and now on CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio.
The following is part of a segment that was first broadcast in January of this year. Psychiatrist Alexandre Houdon says clinicians are beginning to ask a difficult question. Can generative AI exacerbate or even trigger Psychosis in Vulnerable People. Udon is a medical psychiatrist at the Institut Universitaire en Santé Mentale de Montréal and an adjunct professor at the Université de Montréal. He broached the phenomenon some have termed AI psychosis in an article in The Conversation and in one published in the academic journal JMIR Mental Health. On today's program, we'll hear from Udon about what the concerns are and what AI psychosis means.
I'm Dr. Alexandre Udon. I'm a medical psychiatrist at the Institute of Mental Health in Montreal. I'm also a professor adjunct at the University of Montreal. And I'm conducting a lot of research involving AI and mental health.
And I am very grateful to you for making some time today to talk about AI psychosis. But before we do that, I'm hoping that you could help explain to me just what exactly is psychosis and what does it look like if we put aside the AI part for now?
So psychosis it's a state where a person will lose contact with shared reality. So if we put that in simple terms, it's when the brain has difficulty to distinguish between what comes from inside, so what is pertaining to my thoughts, my beliefs, my interpretation of the world around me, and what actually comes from the outside world. So when we talk about psychosis in mental health terms, usually we're going to have different signals or signs such as delusions. Delusions, they are fixed beliefs that are not shared by other people. For example, I'm being monitored by the government. This has a special meaning for me. But even with factual information, this will be unmovable. Nobody is going to be able to make me change my mind. We also look at hallucinations. So sometimes people can say I'm hearing voices or seeing things that others do not. We can also see in psychosis states disorganized thinking. So when an idea becomes really hard to follow or disconnected, or if, for example, I'm talking to you and I'm jumping from one subject to another to the point you're like, oh, Dr. Udon, what is he saying? It's difficult. I'm not so sure what he's talking about right now. And there's that question of loss of insight. So the person himself or herself may not be able to realize entirely that something's going wrong. So it can be temporary or chronic. So when we see a psychosis state that is temporary, sometimes it's mostly psychosis episodes that are induced. So for example, with substance abuse or under extreme stress or sleep deprivation, because we're often under the idea that only people that are really, really sick experience psychosis, but experiencing hallucinations can be up to 15% of the population. So if you put someone under a certain load of stress or sleep deprivation, they will start experiencing psychosis states. And chronic conditions, they involve mostly severe mood disorders or psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia or other types of psychosis disorder.
What do you think it's important for people who maybe they don't have a close contact kind of experience with psychosis, either themselves or in their family or anything? What do you think it's important for folks in that situation to know about psychosis? What are maybe some misconceptions out there?
I think it's really important for people to understand that psychosis itself, it's not a personality flaw or lack of intelligence or a problem with cognition and things like that. It is really a brain-mind state that can affect anyone under certain conditions. And specific conditions, it's mostly a stress-related state. So people, they have vulnerability, a genetic vulnerability to experience psychosis. But the thing is that we don't know, like, I don't know what's, am I vulnerable or not until we experience psychosis. But what we know is that if you put someone with a certain number of stressors, they're going to at some point experience psychosis if I don't remove these stressors. So I want them to understand that this state can be resolved, because even if it's chronic or if it's induced or something that's very acute, there are ways to resolve a psychosis state. There are certain triggers. We need to identify these triggers. and we need to give the appropriate treatments. And the treatment can involve several things. So in terms of chronic conditions, it can involve medication. In terms of more acute stressors, such as what we see in substance-induced psychosis and things like that, we're going to do some psychotherapeutic approaches that target substance use disorders and things like that. So it's really person-dependent. We have to really personalize the treatment and the approach depending on the person we have in front of us. But keep in mind that it has nothing to do with you, yourself, your identity, your intelligence. Intelligence, it's really something that's biological.
You've mentioned that psychosis can come with delusions or hallucinations. Are there any commonalities between the delusions that accompany psychosis, that can accompany psychosis? What do we know about where those come from and what causes them?
We know that in most psychotic episodes, the type of hallucinations that people will experience are auditory hallucinations. So they can also experience other types, such as visual, even smelling things that are, there's no associated smells and things like that. And it's mostly done because the brain interprets in a weird way certain signals of the external world, or interprets signals that are not there. So, say I'm hearing a voice, but there's nobody talking to me. Well, it could be just because the part of my brain that's supposed to say, hey, I'm picking up a signal, can you interpret this signal, is sending information to the brain even without this signal, which is something we see when people are experiencing psychosis. And in terms of delusions, it can be very, it can vary from one person to another. But one topic is the type of delusions that we call persecutory delusions. So thinking that people are against us, people are plotting against us, people are coming up to get us in some way, to attack us, people are spying on us. These are the types of delusions that we see more often. But again, it can be very, very different from one person to another. So for certain person, it could be thinking that I'm sure that this person is in love with me, which is what we call erotomaniac delusions. People can have a sense of grandiosity, like being convinced that they are multi-billionaires and things like that, when it's not the case. It's called megalomaniac delusions. So there's all sort of delusions that can occur, but persecutory delusions are the most common.
Now, how is AI entering into this conversation? If we were to say the word AI psychosis, what do we mean?
So it's really interesting because this popped up in the media, this word AI psychosis and things like that, but it's not a formal diagnosis. It's really more of a clinical or descriptive term that is being used to describe situations where interaction with AI systems appears to trigger, worsen, or even shape psychotic symptoms in vulnerable individuals. So, in these cases that we call AI psychosis, the AI itself does not really create psychosis out of nowhere, but it does amplify existing vulnerabilities or reinforce certain delusional beliefs, or blur reality boundaries and things like that. I'll give you an example. I know there's one case that has been reported in the media where there was that guy that was convinced that his mother was attempting to poison him. So he went and interacted with one of the generative AI available online and said, I'm convinced my mother is trying to kill me with poison. And the AI was like, oh, but this is very improbable. Why would this happen? And things like that. And the person said, what would be the different things you would look for if that was the case? So the AI responded with a set of things to think about to ensure if someone or not is trying to poison me. And it just happened that the AI hit some certain triggers, the sense that if your mother is switching the type of food she's preparing you, if the time at which she serves the food are not the same as the usual time, and apparently this was the case. So it reinforced the delusional belief that this person, well, his mother was poisoning him. So unfortunately, the story that appeared in the media, this person killed his mother and killed himself after. So when I say reinforce delusional beliefs, it can be really intense. And this is why we say AI psychosis, because without this implication of AI in this story, well, perhaps this would not have happened. But we don't have any crystal balls, so it's difficult to state if that would have been the case or not.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Alexandre Houdon. He's a medical psychiatrist at the Institut Universitaire en Santé Mentale de Montréal and an adjunct professor at the Université de Montréal. We're talking about the potential interactions between generative AI and psychosis on today's program. In August of last year, Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman shared in a thread on X, formerly Twitter, that reports of delusions, AI psychosis, and unhealthy attachment keep rising. In that thread, he also wrote that companies shouldn't claim or promote the idea that their AIs are conscious, and that the AIs themselves shouldn't promote it either. The idea that it can lead to problems if we anthropomorphize generative AI is something Dr. Houdon touched on in our conversation as well.
It's really early so far to state like what is the the causality between the use of AI and the actual delusions that were being reinforced and things like that. We know from the different stories that appeared on the media and some clinical reports that are starting to be published in the literature. We can start to identify which individuals are most at risk when they interact with AI. And this way we understand that AI, like especially the chatbot agents available and things like that, it's when they play this role of being a confidant or a therapist or something like that, when we start to anthropomorphize, give humane characteristics to that AI, that things start to be problematic. Because it's not AI itself that is the problem, it's more the interaction between the AI. So it's the process which is the problem. So in individuals that are at risk with psychotic disorders or people that already are diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, or that have a history of psychosis. So let's say that that guy who smoked pot once and did a psychotic episode, well, we know that he's vulnerable for psychosis. So we know that this person could be vulnerable when chatting with AI by reinforcing certain beliefs or certain information that could be problematic. And we know that people that experience trauma in the past or dissociative episode where they feel that they were not there at the present time, or they're out of their body, or they're walking on clouds, that's what we call dissociations. And we know that people that are under extreme stress for various conditions could be due to their relationship, their work, their family condition, things like that, or experience social isolation, substance use problem, or sleep deprivation, are more prone to experience reinforcements of delusions when interacting with AI.
Are some of the concerns that are maybe showing up in wider media reports around this idea of AI psychosis, are those things that you are encountering in your practice?
Well, it's tricky because it's not something we actually screen for at the moment. I do try to screen this now because I'm conducting research in that field. But when you do your psych training or any other professional in the field of mental health, there's very little information made available about how to screen what we call cyber habits, like computer use, using video games, using the internet, like what do we consider a problematic use versus what is a sane use of that. So now I start screening regularly my patients with their usage with Gen AI. And the difficulty I experience right now is that, for example, I have some patients telling me, well, you're treating me for that condition using this molecule, but ChatGPT or any other AI source said that I should use this instead for that period of time. And then you try to explain them what's behind your choice of molecule or why you took a certain treatment plan. And they argue with you with the arguments provided by AI. But the thing we have to keep in mind is that the AI, when it's interacting with a user, it's making a mathematical profile of that user because AI, it's not the human. It's really just a set of mathematics, logic, equations that attempts to give you content that's going to please you. So it only gets a picture of who you are from the information you give it. So the AI is not aware of the entire context of the person. So when it's attempting to personalize interactions and things like that, it's really more often a mirror effect of what the user wants or wants to hear. So now you're trying to explain a treatment plan to a user that's being reinforced by an AI conversation and things like that. And that creates really a really more difficult conversation as compared to when people were using Google or were conducting their own research and came up with a scientific paper or a media article or things like that. Said, is that good? Is that bad? Should I use this? Should I use that? Now we have some form of artificial intelligence providing counter arguments that have really little to do with the clinical realities of the person because the AI itself is not aware of what's going on. So that's the sort of things we start seeing right now. I started to do a literature review of all the cases where AI was related or linked to suicide attempts or completed suicide and psychosis-like adverse events. Now, so far, we retrieved about 60 cases in North America, and we're attempting to publish that in the next few months. And we're trying to identify profiles of these users to understand more what caused that link between the adverse event and the AI use. So that's what's coming up, but it's still a very new phenomenon that we're trying to study and try to establish treatment plans.
That was psychiatrist Alexandre Houdon speaking with me in January about the interplay between generative AI and psychosis. You can find the full version of that interview on our podcast feed. Use the search terms People First Radio, Alexandre Houdon, AI, psychosis. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. If you want to get in touch, you can write to news@chly.ca. Put People First Radio in the subject line. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.